America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom in the American way. Tom Hartman here with you back from Deutschland, from Germany, and great to be back. I was at the 50th anniversary of Kinder and Jugendhilfswerk Salem, otherwise known as Salem, or Salem as they pronounce it in Germany, the international relief organization that I've been doing volunteer work with for over 30 years, on whose model my wife and I, Louise and I, started 29 years ago in New Hampshire, the New England Salem Children's Village, and 10 years ago, the Hunter School for ADHD kids. And there's another program in Maryland, the Maryland Salem Children's Village. I helped start the program in Uganda, helped start a program in Bogota, Colombia, helped start programs in India and in Israel. In fact, Chaim Feingold from Or Shalom, which is now the largest Israeli child caring program in that entire country, was there in Germany with us as well. In fact, he and I led the Shabbat service, Saturday night Sabbath service. And it was a fantastic time. It was a wonderful time. And people from all over the world working for peace, which is the name of the organization. Salem comes from Shalom and Salem, the Hebrew and Arabic words for peace. And just great stuff. I had a great time and hung out with some fantastic people. And it was I'm totally rejuvenated, even though it was a long haul home. But I come back and everything that's in the news is really quite remarkable. I want to start out with a jolly good fellow here to Ken Salazar. He's speaking what most people are afraid to speak, and that is simply cutting off funds to Iraq. He says He says he has previously not supported Congress using its ability to stop war payments in order to force President Bush to change direction. But yesterday he said Congress should look at cutting off funds. See, this is the thing. This whole stuff about, we have to have 67 votes in the Senate to override a veto. You have to have 60 votes in the Senate to stop a filibuster. Sorry, you only need to have 40 votes in the Senate. And only a minority or only a simple majority of votes, or not actually even less than that, in the House of Representatives to prevent legislation from being passed. In other words, you can simply vote no. Yeah, a one vote majority in the House of Representatives and out of the 100 people in the House in the United States Senate, only 40 to say, no, you got no more money, George. Sorry. You want to have a war? Good luck. You've got $2 trillion missing in the Pentagon budget. Maybe you can look under some carpets and find it. But good luck. Which brings us to the larger issue. And by the way, in the second hour of our program today, we're going to have an in-depth conversation, rather long conversation with John Dean. I'm very much looking forward to this, a fellow that I have tremendous respect for. And he has a new book out about how our government is broken. And it's really the third part of a sequel or a trilogy of three books that he's written. But in the first hour, I want to talk a little bit about Iran and some of the problems of the world. In our third hour, more open hour, taking your calls and issues of the day. Our telephone number, by the way, toll-free across the United States, 1-866-303-2270. And if you want to drop into our live chat room, you can go to tomhartman.com and click live chat up at the top of the page, or airamerica.com, go to the Tom Hartman page. There's a link to our live chat room. Our blog is at airamerica.com. Our message board over at tomhartman.com. So there's lots of resources and lots of ways to interact with this program and with each other in real time in the real program. So one of the things that when I was in Europe, frankly, watching the European press and then coming back here and seeing the American press as well, really, really, really seems to be at the top of everyone's radar screen is that the Bush administration appears to be, and it's not just the Bush administration. In fact, I probably should stop using that phrase, because this is really the Reich. This is the crazies within the Republican Party, and a few of the crazies within the Democratic Party, and at least one independent crazy, are ginning up for a war against Iran. And the world is watching this, and it is patently transparent, because we've seen this movie before. We saw this movie in 1939, as I recall, when I wasn't around to recall it, but I believe that was the year when Hitler attacked Poland, saying that they represented that they had weapons of mass destruction, that they had they were amassing troops on their borders, that they were getting ready to attack Germany, preemptively attacked. And for that attack, many people in that Reich were held accountable in the Nuremberg trials for preemptive war. Preemptive war is a crime. And then we preemptively attacked Iraq, which in my opinion is a war crime that George Bush, Dick Cheney, Don Rumsfeld, Condoleezza Rice, and Colin Powell are guilty of, and I, in my opinion, frankly, and respectfully, should be held to account in a in an international tribunal of sorts. But now they want to take it to the next step, apparently. I mean, this is what we're hearing from a whole variety of sources, is that the next step is going to be striking Iran. The Telegraph, yesterday as I was taking the train across Germany, I had in Kulmbach picked up every English language newspaper I could find, and one of them was the Telegraph. And the Sunday Telegraph, the headline, Bush setting America up for war in Iran. It's pretty unambiguous, screaming headline. Senior American intelligence and defense officials believe that President George W. Bush and his inner circle are taking steps to place America on the path to war with Iran, the Sunday Telegraph has learned. Pentagon planners have developed a list of up to 2,000 bombing targets in Iran amid growing fears among serving officers. You get this? Amid growing fears among serving officers? That diplomatic efforts to slow Iran's nuclear weapons program are doomed to fail. Under the theory which is gaining credence in Washington security circles, and again, where have we seen this movie before? I mean, you know, aren't we, isn't this very much, once again, like it was in 2002? In the fall of 2002, remember Andy Card? Oh, you don't roll out a program in the summer, you wait until the fall, that's when you roll out a new program. That's sure enough, they did. Under the theory which is gaining credence in Washington security circles, U.S. action would provoke a major Iranian response, perhaps in the form of moves to cut off Gulf oil supplies. In other words, we provide a small provocation, right? We, say, bomb one of their one of the facilities where they're enriching nuclear fuel. By the way, to the level necessary to fuel the nuclear power plants that we sold them when our guy, the Shah of Iran, was running their country. U.S. action would provoke a major Iranian response, perhaps in the form of moves to cut off Gulf oil supplies, providing a trigger for airstrikes against Iran's nuclear facilities and even its armed forces. Senior officials, this is where it gets really interesting. Senior officials believe Mr. Bush's inner circle has decided he does not want to leave office without first ensuring that Iran is not capable of developing a nuclear weapon. An intelligence source said, this is somebody within the White House speaking off the record to the Sunday Telegraph in the United Kingdom, said no one outside that tight circle knows what's going to happen. But he said within the CIA, quote, many, if not most officials, believe that diplomacy is failing and that the top Pentagon brass believes the same. He said, quote, a strike will follow a gradual escalation. Over the next few weeks and months, the U.S. will build tensions and evidence around Iranian activities in Iraq. They note, interestingly, that up until this time, prior to this, apparently, in the opinion of the Sunday Telegraph anyway, up until the time of this announcement in the British press, most of the people who have been claiming that Bush was intending to attack Iran have been his critics, is the word that they use. People like Scott Ritter, who on this program a number of times has said, you know, any day now Bush is going to go after Iran, or Seymour Hersh. But now they say, previously, but now many senior operatives within the CIA are highly critical of Bush's handling of the Iraq war, though they themselves are considered ineffective and unreliable by hardliners close to Mr. Cheney. The vice president is said to advocate the use of bunker-busting tactical nuclear weapons against Iran's nuclear sites. Gee, might that be like the kinds of weapons that were moved from Minot down to Barksdale Air Force Base last week by accident? To Barksdale Air Force Base, the place where they stage bunker-busting nuclear weapons off to the Middle East? What an interesting coincidence. State Department source familiar with White House discussion said that Ms. Rice, the Secretary of State, of course, under pressure from senior counterproliferation officials to acknowledge that military action may be necessary, is now working with Mr. Cheney to find a way to reconcile their positions and present a united front to the president. She's been opposed to this. The source said when you go down there and see the body language, you can still see that Cheney is still the man, capital T, capital M. The official contrasted the efforts of the Secretary of State to work with the Vice President with the, quote, open warfare between Colin Powell and Don Rumsfeld before the Iraq War. Ms. Rice's bottom line is that the administration has, if it's to go to war again, it must build the case over a period of months and win sufficient support on Capitol Hill. But basically, she said, okay, George, if you can sell this thing, I'll go along with it. Mohammed El-Baradei is weighing in on this. I got to tell you what he said and what Abizaid said right after this.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio.
Be back. Thanks so much. Tom Hartman here with you. Now, Mohammed El-Baradei, I find this fascinating. You go back and you look at who were the voices of truth before the war in Iraq. The war in Iraq that lasted only a few months. It was successfully completed. And the declaration, of course, on May 1st, 2003.
My fellow Americans, major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
And sure enough, he was right. We do have a military that knows how to take down a country and kill its leaders and seize its properties and even rewrite its constitutions in violation of international law. We did it. We had a successful war, an illegal war, but a successful war, followed by an absolutely incompetent occupation because it was being driven by conservative economic ideology with the flat 15% tax and denationalizing industries and doing away with Social Security and national health care and privatizing public education and higher education in particular, throwing open the doors of the country to multinational corporations and saying there's no such thing as illegal immigration. You can bring any kind of labor in you want for any kind of price. And so you got people from Sri Lanka and Bangladesh in there working for, 20 cents an hour instead of the $4 or $5 a day that an Iraqi might charge, and on and on and on. And it failed. Conservative economics failed in Iraq. Of course, you don't hear the cons talking about that so much these days. You go back and you read their documents from 1998 all the way through to 2003 about how they were going to create such a paradise that they didn't even have to have a plan B. And you get it, that a good part of the reason why we invaded Iraq was so that the conservatives could finally, after 60 years, after Roosevelt and Truman, through the instrument of Germany and Japan and many of the other countries of Western Europe as they were rebuilt, showed that if you have regulated capitalism, if you have strong labor unions, if you have strong and a strong social safety net with the equivalent of a social security program and national health care thing, that you can have prosperity. And if you have national manufacturing policies and national trade policies that protect the local workers and the local industries through tariffs and trade protections. Protectionism. Oh, my God. If you do that, you can build an enormous and mighty force. And in fact, to this day, Japan protects its economy. To this day, China protects its economy. To this day, India protects its economy. We don't. So anyhow, we had this successful war in Iraq, followed by an unsuccessful occupation driven entirely by conservative economic ideology that failed and has always failed every time it's been tried anywhere in the world. And that not good enough. Now they want to go to war in Iraq. So I find this, two very, very interesting things about, or in Iran rather, excuse me, two very, very interesting things about this. The first is that Mohammed El-Baradei, IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, this is the watchdog, the nuclear energy watchdog agency of the United Nations, the chief UN nuclear inspector, Mohammed El-Baradei. He says, if you're talking about attacking Iran, And you're doing so because you see some kind of a threat there. He calls this hype. This is an article by George John in the Associated Press saying, only the UN Security Council could authorize the use of force. El Baradei urged the world to remember Iraq before considering any similar action against Iran. He told reporters, quote, there are rules on how to use force, and I would hope that everybody would have gotten the lesson after the Iraq situation where 700,000 innocent civilians have lost their lives on the suspicion that a country has nuclear weapons. As Hans Blix was saying.
I'm not ever suggested that they were sort of willfully and consciously lying, but I think that they wanted to jump to conclusions. I said in the Security Council that if something is unaccounted for, it doesn't necessarily mean that they exist. And I think there was that tendency to jump to that conclusion. We were there for 3.5 months, after all, and we did not find any smoking gun. And now that the U.S. has been, the U.K. had been there for quite some time, and they had the opportunity to interrogate people, they had had the whole cream of the Iraqi establishment in custody, and people should not be scared any longer to answer in the interviews. With this long period, I'm inclined to think that the Iraqi statement that they destroyed all the biological and chemical weapons which they had in the summer of 1991 may well be the truth.
Yeah, and in fact, he was saying that the week before we attacked Iraq. And now El Baradei is saying the same thing about attacking Iran. Russia and China expressed alarm today over comments by France's foreign minister that Paris should prepare for the prospect of war with Iran. The French foreign minister, Kouchner, he said he asked for French firms not to bid for work in Iran. He says, we must prepare for the worst. The worst, sir, is war. And Russia and China both saying, what? El Baradei, in the meantime, now is accusing the Democrats of distorting the Iranian data that he himself has put together. The Democrats of distorting this information. I'll share that with you right after the break, and then we'll be taking your calls at 866-303-2270. Are we about to go to war with Iran? 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Business like oil business. Oil, I think it's over $81 a barrel today. My guess would be that is the world betting that Bush actually is going to attack Iran, and then Iran will try and shut down the Straits of Hormuz, and then you're going to see $130 a barrel of oil, which apparently is what Mr. Greenspan said in his autobiography would have happened if we hadn't attacked Iraq. Say what? Like we're getting a lot of oil from there right now. By the way, head over to the airamerica.com/Tom Hartman page and join our blog today. Put you in the running for our giveaway of a copy of my book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. At the end of the day, my show's producer, David Poole, is going to just pick out his favorite blog of the day and that posting on the blog of the day. And that person will receive an autographed copy of the book in the mail. So anyhow, here's what Mohammed El Baradei said. I repeat, we have not seen any undeclared facilities operate. Now, keep in mind that right now, El Baradei and his weapons inspectors from the United Nations have largely unrestricted, unlimited access to Iran. They're running all over the country. They're looking at things. He says, I repeat, we have not seen any undeclared facilities operating in Iran. We have not seen any concrete evidence that the Iran program is being weaponized. We have not received any information to that effect. So I haven't heard any other information to the contrary. So while we're still concerned about the nature of the Iranian program, we should not. I do not believe at this stage that we are facing clear and present danger that requires that we go beyond diplomacy. And then over at Amy Goodman's site, Democracy Now!, which is a significant news network or has become and doing great work, they note, meanwhile, congressional Democrats are being accused of drafting a misleading and erroneous report on Iran's nuclear program. Alvaradi said the congressional report released by Democratic Congressman Rush Holt of New Jersey contains serious distortions of the IAEA's own findings on Iran's nuclear activity. The report claimed Iran had enriched uranium to weapons-grade level when the IAEA had found only small quantities of enrichment at far lower levels. So what's the deal? Democrats in Congress distorting the information, or is this something that just slipped by? I mean, time will tell, but it sure does look to me like this thing is being cranked up, and it's being cranked up rapidly. In the meantime, General John Abizaid, remember him? I mean, this is a guy, you know, one of... he's now the retired Army general, but he headed CENTCOM. For 4 years, he was the commander of the U.S. Central Command, ultimately in charge of what was going on in the Middle East. He says the world can live with a nuclear-armed regime in Tehran. Now, this is assuming the worst case, which the U.N. says isn't even happening. But he says, yeah. He says, Iran is not, I'm quoting now from John Abizaid, the retired general. He said, Iran is not a suicide nation. I mean, they may have some people in charge that don't appear to be rational, but I doubt that the Iranians intend to attack us with a nuclear weapon. He says, there are ways to live with a nuclear Iran. Let's face it. We live with a nuclear Soviet Union. We've lived with a nuclear China. We're living with other nuclear powers as well. War, in the state-to-state sense, in that part of the region, would be devastating for everybody, he said. And we should avoid it, in my mind, to every extent that we can. Well, gee, of course, he's a military guy. And it's always the military guys who are saying, no, we don't want to have any more preemptive wars. We don't want to have any more illegal wars. We don't want to have to stand in the court in The Hague in another military tribunal. We don't want to be guilty of war crimes. We don't want to see more people die because we've been there and done it and seen it. But then you got guys like Cheney with his five deferments and Rice, who was never in the military, and George, who went AWOL for over a year and was never held accountable for it, who are like, yeah, war's fun. War is macho. War gives the president more powers. I'm frankly very concerned about this. And I'm letting my elected officials know that I'm very concerned about this. That we are seeing what we've been predicting now for some time on this program, and a number of our guests have as well, that we are seeing a rush to war in Iran. And I think it's going to happen as soon as they've got Iraq. Their cash, this $50 billion that they want for Iraq, as soon as they've got that under their belt, Iran's going to be next. And it's going to come just in time for the 2008 elections, by the way. In my opinion, this is also the ace in the hole card for the Republicans, is that they think that when they have a good war going against what are perceived broadly by the public as bad guys, that it helps out Republican candidates, the hawk-like Republican candidates. Over the weekend, one of the columnists in the New York Times, I forget which one it was now, but because I read it on the plane here on the way over from Germany, one of the columnists was pointing out that in his opinion, what is happening is that the Democrats, just like with Vietnam, the Democrats are going to be set up as, oh, they're the ones who lost the war. They're going to rewrite history to say, oh yeah, we could have won the Vietnam War if we just had another year. If the peaceniks are just, and it ain't true. And it's not true in Iraq either. 1-866-303-2270, your telephone number. Howard, Pennsylvania, listening at 1360 AM. Hey, Howard, what's up?
Yes, can you hear me?
I can, and you are on the air.
Okay. I don't know how I come across this idea in my brain, but here's my idea. As you just said, the Republicans keep putting the Democrats on the defense, and I hate to see the Democrats continually on a defense. So I've thought about this idea where you would come up with what would be called a war tax. And what I'm saying by that...
It's like what Woodrow Wilson did with World War I, what Franklin Roosevelt did with World War II, and you simply say, if you're going to, and what, for that matter, what Lincoln did, he put a 1% tax on all income for the Civil War. If you're going to have a war, you're going to pay for it, right?
Well, listen now, Tom, let's not hurt the poor and the middle class.
Right.
This is going to have to start at a certain income level, which I don't know what it would be. But let's not hurt the poor and the middle class.
Yeah, well, let's go back to the way it was before Reagan. Before Reagan, you had 71% tax after Kennedy and a 91% tax before Kennedy, and it didn't kick in until after you had made $3.2 million in today's dollars.
Right.
And, you know, that's true progressive taxation. Howard, I think you're onto something, and I think that if the Democrats want to be fiscally sound, like Greenspan says they were under Clinton, and he's criticizing Republicans for it in his new book, if they want to be fiscally sound, they should be saying, yeah, fine, George, you want to have a war? Give us a tax that goes along with it. Mark in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hey, Mark.
Tom, I'm so glad there's somebody like you on the airwaves letting everybody know all about this. You don't know how many times I've been screaming at my radio until I got on here. This entire war is ridiculous. These accusations that he's going to go into Iran, I believe every one of them. I know that's been on the agenda for a while. He's looking for an excuse. If he can't find one, he'll make one up. And I agree with you completely. Cut off all funding.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. You're absolutely right. Yeah, and the Democrats have the power to do that. Forget about 67 votes, 60 votes, any of this. They can simply say, no, we're not going to send you any more money. You got plenty of money to get the guys out of there now. Out of there now. And, fine. That's it. End of discussion. They can do it, and they could do it in a very straightforward fashion. Art in Colorado. Hey, Art.
Hello.
Hey, you're on the air.
Okay. Hey, Tom.
Yes, sir. Yes, Art.
How do we get on this runaway train, you know?
You mean how do we get off it, or how do we get onto it?
And then how do we get off of it?
Well, we're getting onto it by exactly what Dwight Eisenhower warned us about, which is this the military-industrial complex, you know, basically. I mean, you know, he was, you know, quite explicit in it. And the way we get off it, I think, is by remembering what Eisenhower said and realizing that an inappropriate amount of power has been concentrated in the hands of those who would make war, and it needs to be recognized and taken back.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes.
And I would say it has and it is. Rich in Birmingham, Alabama. Hey, Rich, you had a question?
Welcome home, Tom.
Thank you.
Two quick questions. You seem to have a real fondness for the country of Germany, and I was curious the roots of that. And there seems to be so many things in that country that they're doing right. The way the government subsidizes solar panels and wind power, their mass transit.
Well, just real quickly, because we've got to take a break within about 60 seconds here. Sure. But let me answer you, Rich. Back in 1978, I was running an ad agency in Michigan, and I was hired by this German charity to help promote a concert tour around the United States to raise money for a program that was starting here. I was so impressed by the project, by the organization. Afterwards, we were in the Watergate Hotel in August of 1978 after the children had played at the UN and the Lincoln Center and Kennedy Center. The founder, Gottfried Mueller, and Louise and I were there. Justin, our son, had just been born. He was just a few weeks old. I'd gone home. We had a home birth. And we were sitting there, and he turned to me and he said, "Why don't you sell your business and do something worthwhile with your life?" And I turned to Louise and I said, "What do you think?" And she said, "Yeah, let's do it." And so we sold the business and we moved to New Hampshire and eventually bought 136 acres of land and built three houses there. And that program is still there and it's still running, the New England Salem Children's Village. And for 30 years, ever since then, I've worked with them. It's just a coincidence that it was in Germany. He's an extraordinary man. He's 94 years old. I spent 45 minutes with him day before yesterday. And his final words to me were, "Are you fulfilling your destiny to bring peace to the world? Ja oder nein? Yes or no? Are you doing the work or not?" And I said, "Yes, I am. Ja." And he said, "Good." And then he said, "I am looking into eternity now." 94. He said, "I'm looking into the eternity beyond eternities. And it's beautiful." 45 minutes past the hour.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
ladies and gentlemen, Senator Larry Craig.
Hey there, what you doing out there? Here in this men's room, these stall could be 10 rooms for romance. I can hear somebody going. I can hear the dryer blowing. You've got a flight soon, but I think I might soon have no pants. Oh, my sweet meat, tap three times on the pipe if you want me. Twice on the pipe if you brought me a leash. Oh, my darling, means you'll meet me in the jetway. Come on, knock on the door if you're not the police.
Yeah.
This, of course, does not mean I'm gay. Sex isn't gay if it's done by two straight guys together.
You tell him, Larry Craig. Yeah. This in the news, by the way, this, I don't have a dateline. I'm not sure exactly what the source of this is. But when, you know, your generic news source, when tourists ask for the bathroom in Minneapolis airport lately, it's usually not because they have to go. It's because they want to see the stalls made famous by U.S. Senator Larry Craig's arrest. It's become a tourist attraction, says Karen Evans, the information specialist at the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport. People are taking pictures of it. Yeah, walking into the men's room and taking pictures. That sounds like more Larry Craig's out there. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And let's see here, Mondel in Santa Monica, California. Hey, Mondel, welcome to the program.
Oh, hello.
Hello, you are on the air.
Hi there, it's Bill, actually.
Oh, I'm sorry. Hello, Bill.
I'm Bill in Santa Monica. Sorry, I'm out of breath. I was just running. Have a quick comment. I really enjoy your show. Listen to it often. I guess my comment is more on a question of why is it that people in the liberal media, which I am, I'm a liberal Democrat, NPR, Air America, local talk shows, do not have on a regular basis our Democratic leaders on to really hold them more accountable.
Well, first of all, I would submit to you that the National Public Radio is not the liberal media. It's simply the media.
Well,
and in fact, it is headed up by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which is now led by Republicans.
Right.
Partisan Republicans. But yeah, you're absolutely right. Why are we not holding our leaders to account? I mean, it's amazing. You watch C-SPAN and you watch Prime Minister's questions where the Prime Minister gets up there and members of Congress are shouting questions at him and yelling at him and things. We need to be holding our elected officials, responsible. And there really are four branches of government. There are three official ones, and then the fourth unofficial one is the media. We'll get into that with John Dean in the next hour when we talk with him. Matt in Newburgh, Oregon. Hey, Matt, what's up?
Hey, I had a question for you. You were talking about conservative trade policy screwing up Iraq. Mm. And I was going to ask you about your comment about protectionism. I've been studying protectionism over the last year. And of all people, I read about it from Pat Buchanan. So I was going to ask you why you're associating it with kind of a more liberal ideology.
Well, right, even a stopped clock is right twice a year. Pat Buchanan was opposed to the war in Iraq, and Pat Buchanan is in favor of tariff-based trade policies. I think he's right. He disagrees with virtually every Republican in the world and with most conservatives. But I think on those two things, he's right. So
right, what I'm saying is
I'm not going to refuse to agree with somebody just because of their ideology in other areas. I mean,
I agree.
Yeah, and in fact, you know, protectionist trade policies are what built this country. The only reason that we've made textiles in the United States for the last 200 years is because we protected textiles, you know, textile mills and things with import tariffs. The only reason that we made blue jeans in the United States, the only reason why pretty much anything was made in the United States was because we protected our domestic industries, and we no longer do that. And guess what? We no longer make anything here. But that's a whole nother riff. Chris in Pennsylvania, and thanks for the call, though. Chris in Pennsylvania, what's up, Chris?
Oh, hi, Tom. Love your show. I listen to you on Sirius, and they only play it for 1 hour. They don't play your full show.
Well, they actually play the whole show, but they delay the rest of it a little later on. But that's a whole nother discussion, Chris. What's on your mind?
Well, I wanted to talk to you. You were mentioning earlier about Congress, defunding the war in Iraq. And I'm a Democrat, mm-hmm. and I totally believe they should. But my little theory, and I want your thoughts on my idea, I'm a little cynical as to whether or not the Democrats will actually defund the war. And the only reason I would say that is because if Congress holds out for another year and keeps funding the war that Democratic nominee then can run on a platform, well, I'm going to pull us out of war in Iraq, kind of like give the general public another year to hate the war, and then when the Democratic nominee...
I understand, Chris, and I agree with you. And you know, tragically, many more people will die as a consequence of this policy. And I don't think that it's a Democratic strategy, frankly. I think it's playing into the hands of the Republican strategy. And the Republican strategy is, frankly, that it's a heads I win, tails you lose kind of proposition that George Bush has put together here, where if the Democrats allow the war to continue and somebody else inherits it, then Bush, then whenever the war is over, there's going to be a moment. And even though now the best estimate, and this from the Telegraph also in the UK, or the Independent in the UK published this over the weekend, that at least 1 million civilians have died in Iraq so far. We have the second largest refugee crisis on earth right now, behind Darfur. The second largest refugee crisis in Iraq. 2.5 million internally displaced persons, refugees within their own country. 2 million who have fled the country. 4.5 million refugees in Iraq as a result of our efforts. So there is going to be, there already is. I would say that the bloodshed, the slaughter is already of mind-boggling proportions. But on that day when we finally do pull out, there will be some iconic photograph like that one that we all remember of people trying to grab the helicopter at the top of the embassy in Saigon. And that will be used by the Republicans, assuming that it's a Democratic president that ends this war. That will be used by them to reinvent history and for the next generation and the generation after that, just like they tried to reinvent history about Vietnam, to say, oh, look it. You know, we Republicans, we were doing it just fine, and then the Democrats came along and they screwed it all up. That's my prediction, and I fear the Democrats are going to play right into it. John Dean up
next. Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio. Hartman Program on Air America Radio, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
And welcome back, my friends, to our program live from Los Angeles to New York, from Pennsylvania to Seattle, from Detroit to Denver, all places in between. Tom Hartman here with you. John Dean was the White House legal counsel to President Nixon for 1,000 days. He served as chief minority counsel for the House Judiciary Committee, associate deputy attorney general in the U.S. Department of Justice, the author of three truly brilliant, brilliant books, Worse Than Watergate, The Secret Presidency of George W. Bush, Conservatives Without Conscience, in which he carried on, I should probably check with him and make sure that he would use this phrase, but carried on a mission given to him by Barry Goldwater, of all people. Would that be accurate, Mr. Dean?
That would be accurate.
Yeah, and at least that was what I took away from it. And Broken Government, your new book, How Republican Rule Destroyed the Legislative, Executive, and Judicial Branches. John Dean, it's an honor to have you with us, particularly for an extended conversation here. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Tom. Pleasure to be there.
In your book, Broken Government, your new book, How Republicans Destroyed the Legislative, Executive, and Judicial Branches, something occurred to me as I was reading through it, and that is that in the minds of the founders, or of the framers anyway, of the Constitution, that there was to a certain extent a fourth branch of government, and I don't refer to the people, which I think you could probably strongly argue is the fourth branch of government, but there was one institution, one economic and business institution that the framers identified in the Constitution in the First Amendment. And gave it special status, and it wasn't the military-industrial complex or the weapons industry or, you know, the horses or the Pony Express. It was the press, and
that's
what sometimes referred to as the Fourth Estate. I want to get into you how the Republicans have destroyed the executive, legislative, and judicial branch, but I'm wondering what your thoughts are on how Republican rule has affected the Fourth Estate.
Well, it's interesting. In the years before Watergate, Washington was given pretty much the benefit of all doubts. After Watergate, you had a 180-degree swing where people in Washington, particularly the president, but members of Congress as well, were presumed to be doing the wrong thing until they proved otherwise. And that really was something of the norm, a lot of investigative reporting, a lot of probing, character analysis, what have you, up until and through the 2000 campaign, where that continued for Al Gore, but for some reason they gave Bush a pass. And I've asked an awful lot of members of the White House press corps and the Washington press corps why that happened. I said, was it corporate consolidation where the boss is saying, now that you're owned by a big company, we want you to go easy on these people, they are our kind of people? And seldom did I hear that as an explanation. I heard very frequently, however, because of corporate consolidation, that there was so much on particularly the print reporters' agenda, if not those in the other media, but they just had too much work to do to begin to really get into in-depth anything really serious. Another thing, it's been generational. There are people now in the Washington Press Corps, by and large, most of them, they don't have any active memory of even Iran-Contra, not to mention Watergate. Those are all historical events. But really, the hardest reason and the best explanation I was given, the Bush people were very good at stiffing the press initially. Excuse me. And not until everything fell apart on them, where they, you know, there were no weapons of mass destruction, Katrina, just one act of incompetence after another, and they just couldn't stop reporting on it. And now they've also, we've got now with the change of power in Congress, we've got some oversight, so they're having a little bit more trouble keeping all that buried. But that explains why they seem to have just let Bush have a pass for 6 years, and but it's not working anymore.
Yeah, well, it may be systemic. I had a conversation with Dan Rather some time ago, and he suggested that his boss, Walter Cronkite, drew a salary that was basically an upper middle class salary.
That's
that
exactly
back
right.
Then in the news media, you weren't a star. You were an employee, and the news operation ran at a loss. They had news bureaus all over the world. They viewed themselves as fulfilling a public trust that was required for their radio and television stations to maintain their license. And now you've got guys who are, you know, the Washington Press Corps, who are making $300,000, $500,000 a year, $700,000 a year, in some cases more than $1 million a year. And they know that they will lose that salary if they lose their access to the president, and so they're sucking up.
That's exactly right, and that's why, as I say, the Bush administration was very effective. If somebody wrote a negative story or reported a negative story, they got stiffed, and they didn't have access, and they wouldn't return their calls, and this would just hit right at the pocketbook. But as I say, as after that collective judgment came out that something's seriously amiss here, it's now started to change.
Yeah, well, let's hope so. In your chapter, one of your first chapter, Process Matters, you talk about government. And I'd like to just a very 9 seconds here of Ronald Reagan that I think is emblematic. And then I'd like your thoughts on some of the people that you're quoting.
I've always felt the 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
And Reagan really began a war on the idea of small d democracy itself, did he not?
He certainly did. He, for reasons that are not fully explained in any of his own writings that I've looked at, he saw government as the enemy. And it's mystifying why a man like this would seek the presidency, for example, to come to Washington to announce in his inaugural that the government isn't the solution, it's the problem. This whole thought of so many conservative Republicans that the best thing to do is to shrink the government so small you can drown it in a bathtub is just absurd. It's just not going to happen. The federal government is too important. And now that they also, conservatives, have changed their whole tune on the power of the presidency and are demanding, you know, that be the most powerful branch, you obviously can't have small government and or even the way they're proceeding, fiscal responsibility, the things that Reagan called for, and still have the kind of presidency they want.
And yet in your book, you quote Chuck Hagel, Catherine Harris, Orrin Hatch, Grover Norquist, Ed Meese, Trent Lott, Robert Novak, all essentially saying the same thing that Reagan was saying.
It is the mantra. It is a canon of conservatism today that the government is bad, and it's a negative outlook on what government can do and should do. And I, as I say, it makes no sense. It is not realistic. There are some roles only the federal government can play. Otherwise, we would have 50 different state laws that could be so diverse and so confusing. There are times when you do need the federal courts to step in. You have times when only the resources of the federal government, which taxes all the states, can solve a problem. So it's an anomaly that they've taken all these inconsistent positions. And of course, in my last book, I explained this is very typical of the kind of personality that is now dominating the Republican Party, the authoritarian.
The authoritarian personality, yeah.
Right.
And so what they do is they take an institution that they fundamentally don't believe in, government, and break it and then say, see, it's broken.
That's exactly right. That is exactly right. That is the subtext of the book I've written.
Yeah, and the question I've been rhetorically asking on this question on this program for 5 years is, how can you govern if you don't believe in government? I mean, it makes no sense to me. You in your chapter, The Second Branch, Broken and in Need of Repair, you quote.
Let me just, before we go there,
sure,
just make one
sure
point on this.
Certainly.
On that opening chapter on process. Process is kind of one of those fuzzy, funny, kind of academic-sounding words, but it really, I think Bill Safire, who used to be my colleague at the Nixon White House and later was a New York Times columnist and now is still a wordsmith there, put it right. It really is, is a term that now explains the great machinery of government, both the way it works and the policy it produces is all encompassed in the process. And anybody who ignores process is really ignoring the name of the game. You get good policy with good process, you get bad policy with bad process, and contrary to a lot of conventional wisdom within the Beltway that is telling candidates ignore process, actually the American people are more interested in process in many instances than they are in policy.
Yeah, and frankly, many Americans don't understand the distinction between the two.
Well, there's a fine line. For example, you know, the fact that it's a process matter that say that the Republicans worked 2 days a week when they ran the Congress. They worked from Tuesday afternoon till Thursday morning. That became a policy, in effect.
Yeah. And not a particularly useful one. People very often voting on bills after they'd seen it for 15 minutes. We're talking with John Dean. His new book, Broken Government, How Republican Rule Destroyed the Legislative, Executive, and Judicial Branches, out now. It's 16 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with John Dean right after this. It's the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
Indeed, my friends, we can take back this country. We can bring back the ideals of democracy, the extraordinary concepts and visions the founders and framers fought and died for in generation after generation. 230 years, Americans have fought and died for the ideals of freedom and democracy and for the Constitution of the United States, now so tragically under assault. And we're talking with John Dean, his new book, Broken Government, How Republican Rule Destroyed the Legislative, Executive, and Judicial Branches. John W. Dean. John, is there a website, by the way, that you'd like me to direct people to, or just to the book?
Just the book. Okay, I do write a biweekly column for Fine Law, but that doesn't really deal with the book.
Yeah, I've found many of them to be extraordinary. You're extraordinarily insightful fellow. Your subtitle, How Republican Rule Destroyed the Legislative, Executive, and Judicial Branches. I have a lot of conservatives on this program. In fact, probably we have more Republican and conservative guests on than liberal or Democrats, typically for the purposes of a debate, although it's not the crossfire screaming match kind of debate. It's more like, the way Jon Stewart has them on, you know, let's have a conversation and see if we can find some common ground here. And you have said the GOP poses a threat to the well-being of our nation, and certainly the subtitle of your book implies that. And yet I get a sense from your book that if we look back at the history of the GOP, the Republican Party, which you've been a member of were a member of for many, many years,
and still
that there
today,
is...
Still today, consider myself, I still today consider myself a Goldwater conservative on countless issues.
Okay, that there's tremendous good there. I mean, you know, it's whether you go to Lincoln or Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt, or frankly, I think Dwight Eisenhower was one of our best presidents. How can we avoid just sliding into a he said, she said, a gotcha, a partisan by saying Republican rule? There's really not another word, though, isn't it? It's almost like you'd almost like want to put in the caveat of how the hijacked Republican Party's rule has, or something like that.
Well, I certainly explain that in the book, and as you know, this is the third in an unplanned trilogy where I've laid a lot of predicate for what I'm saying in this book. And, you know, I find it somewhat surprising that I'm having to make this offer this commentary on my former tribe. I always thought they would be pretty good at governing, but they've proven themselves in recent decades that isn't the case. The reason I use the word rule is very intentional, too. I distinguish between rule and governing. Rule is just exercising power. That's what Republicans are best at. They're good at winning elections, and they can exercise power. What they're not very good at is governing, which takes an art and a craft and a little bit more nuance than they're willing to employ that's necessary to make things work. So the word rule was intention. The fact that they have resulted and produced the disasters when they have been in power is explainable. If you look at who's now running the Republican Party, once the Republican Party was a big tent party, as was the Democratic Party. Now we have virtually all an increasingly hard right conservatives running the Republican Party. With, as we were talking earlier, their anti-government attitude, it's little wonder that they have busted the whole thing up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, indeed. And all three branches, frankly. Let's start with the legislative, the first branch mentioned in the Constitution. I think we have about 2 minutes here before we have to take a break at the bottom of the hour, and then we'll have an opportunity for a little longer conversation. What are your thoughts on how the legislative branch has been broken by Republican rule?
Basically what they did is they eliminated after 2 years, 3 years in power, they just said the hell with the deliberative process. They excluded Democrats. They twisted the rules. They deserted what Stone, and particularly in the House, is regular order. It's known in the Senate, but it's the customs, traditions, even the constitutions and laws under which the House operates. They just abandoned them. When there was a vote, they would normally a vote takes 15 minutes. It sometimes go 3 hours. They literally would bribe members to get that one vote victory. When conference committees and the difference between the House and the Senate, they wouldn't even meet when they controlled the Congress if the Democrats were going to show up. These are the sort of things that really fundamentally distorted. So people on both the right and the left were saying, this isn't the way this body's supposed to run.
And yet there are Democrats who are suggesting, and frankly, a number of my listeners who are suggesting that if the Democrat that, you know, that was strong, that was these guys had balls, they were really, and the Democrats should be doing the same. It seems to me that would be a horrible thing.
Well, you know, when the Democrats did take control this year, a lot of Republicans thought they were going to be in for the same kind of retribution that they had given the Democrats. Didn't happen.
Right.
Pelosi set a whole different tone, and she's tried to return civility to the process up there, and she has, and they have changed the rules. But the Republicans are playing a very hard ball game where they're playing this obstructionism, and the American people think the Congress is still not being functioning well.
Yeah, Republicans have holds on, I believe, 85 pieces of legislation right now in the Senate. It's so that they can claim that the Democrats are doing nothing. It's exactly. Astounding. We're talking with John Dean, the author of Worse Than Watergate, Conservatives Without Conscience, and now his new book, Broken Government, How Republican Rule Destroyed the Legislative, Executive, and Judicial Branches. We'll continue our conversation right after the break. Stick around. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
And I believe in the magic of democracy. Welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. We're talking with John Dean. John W. Dean, the author of Worse Than Watergate, The Secret Presidency of George W. Bush, Conservatives Without Conscience, his second book, his third and newest, Broken Government. How Republican Rule Destroyed the Legislative, Executive, and Judicial Branches. John Dean was White House legal counsel to President Nixon for 1,000 days. He served as chief minority counsel for the House Judiciary Committee and as associate deputy attorney general in the U.S. Department of Defense. John Dean, moving to the second branch of government, the presidency.
Yes.
In your book, you go through a series of, I can only call them indictments, I'd say, of things that have been undertaken, particularly by the Bush administration, grabbing power, as it were, by this administration. You talk about torture, violating the laws, surveillance, without any serious consequences. First of all, just a very, very broad question, and then you know, perhaps we can get into some of the specifics of it. Do you believe that impeachment is an appropriate remedy at this point in time for George W. Bush and Dick Cheney?
Well, actually, when I wrote Worse Than Watergate, the first of this trilogy, I laid out the case, showed clearly that Bush and Cheney have committed high crimes and misdemeanors. I went to the actual resolution where they got authority from Congress to go into Iraq, and then they had requirements under that. Few people read the resolution. Few people knew that he actually had to make a formal finding and report to the Congress that there was no diplomatic remedy and to provide evidence why he needed to go. Well, they provided false evidence, totally bogus information to the Congress in this formal finding. And this is a classic example that the founders, when they were debating the Constitution, said would be a high crime and misdemeanor under the Constitution. So there's no question that there is certainly a prima facie case there to proceed with impeachment. I didn't call for it because it's a highly political proceeding. I think that the American people became so put out with what the Republicans did under when they controlled the Congress and they went after Clinton. It was a purely political proceeding, as it always is, but there was no justification for it in that instance. There might well be here, but it's now off the table that the Democrats control the Congress, and probably for the better. This man's on the way out, and what they have to do is figure out how to end this disaster he's created without letting him pin the blame on them for everything that might go wrong. And that's what he's clearly trying to do.
Oh, yeah, and not just the disaster of Iraq.
No.
there's a whole long series of them. So the destruction of the executive branch. Let's speak to that.
Well, you know, I got into this chapter, found an interesting way to open the discussion of what's happened with the executive branch when I noticed that during the first term of this presidency, the Bush-Cheney administration, that historians, unlike any prior president I could find, were saying we might have the worst presidency ever. And it only has continued and accelerated during the second term. And I'm not talking the usual suspects.
The critique goes across the board from right to left, from William Buckley, who's a longtime president watcher, and some of his top people from the National Review saying, we've got the worst presidency ever. I never thought anybody would ever, in history's vision, top James Buchanan, who took us into the Civil War. But historians are saying, look, you know, with this different time, different situation, and much grimmer situation than even Buchanan got us into the Civil War by his inaction. This president has gotten us into the war in Iraq and, you know, exacerbated the problem of terrorism in doing so. And he gets the lowest marks that they can do and can find because of the problems he's created. So I use that vehicle, and I look behind it. Who's behind this? Well, it's very clear. It's Dick Cheney.
Yeah. Now, you note in the book, you quote Professor, is it Rutledge?
Yeah.
Am I pronouncing it right? And his quoting of Sundquist's The Decline and Resurgence of Congress, his 1981 book. And you talk about how Rutledge regarded Ronald Reagan's aggressive use of executive tools as marking the beginning of the White House efforts to roll back the post-Watergate reforms. This is something that's not unique to George W. Bush.
No. Well, what happened, the reason I went into all that is and try to use somebody else's data rather than my own. I had already reached these conclusions, but I decided to take a young political science professor and see what he said, if he agreed, and looked at his evidence to see if it matched up with Cheney's claim that post-Vietnam, post-Watergate, the presidency has been deeply wounded and weakened. It is a absolute ruse. And I used that his material to show that, indeed, starting with Reagan, they rolled back all the post-Watergate reforms. And, indeed, by the time you've got Clinton is being called by many think tanks an imperial president. Well, now, as I say, we've got a presidency that's way beyond the imperial presidency.
James Madison had some very specific comments about perpetual war, that no nation, no democracy could survive. I don't think he used the word democracy, but no nation in a democratic fashion, no republic could survive in a state of perpetual war. And he talked about how during times of war, the powers of the presidency are significantly enhanced, the ability to give out gifts, and control power, and yet this is exactly George Bush and many of his Republican enablers and a few Democrats, frankly, are advocating what seems to be perpetual war. I mean, this is almost Orwellian, is it not?
Well, it's true. Dick Cheney is certainly a poster boy for the military-industrial complex. The pathetic arguments and legal arguments they're using, arguments that if they were ever presented in a courtroom, a judge would probably hold the lawyer in contempt for doing so. They're relying on opinions from young assistants in the Department of Justice that are giving them designer answers, and I actually took the trouble and wrote an appendix to show exactly how, for example, John Yoo has done this and how fraudulent the counsel is that they're giving. To march into war, to undertake torture as an interrogation technique, to get out of our treaty obligations and the Geneva Conventions. I mean, it is Orwellian, and it's hard to believe. And what troubles me most is not so much, you know, what they're doing because they're on their way out. It's what they're leaving behind, not only in precedent, but they have violated the civil service laws in almost every department and agency and embedded people who are going to be there for a very long time.
I did this show from the Conservative Political Action Conference earlier in the year, the CPAC, and Bob Barr, who I've known for many years, and has been on this program many times.
Yeah, I've done Bob's show a number of times.
Yeah, Bob's a decent guy, and I mean, we disagree on a lot of things, but he's, you know, I have a lot of respect for him. And he debated Mr. Yu in front of the entire, you know, it was like one of the main events. There was nothing else going on. Everybody, 3,000 people in the room. And you, in that debate, was making these cliched arguments, fight them over there so we don't have to fight them here, get them before they get us, you know, give up a few liberties in order to have security, it's a good thing. I mean, you know, just spitting in the face, frankly, of Madison and Jefferson and Washington And yet the crowd, which was by and large conservative Republicans, was loving it. I mean, they were by the end, they were booing Bob Barr, and they were gung-ho for you. How is it that's, and this guy's, you know, a professor at Berkeley now, how is it that the Republican Party and that the conservative base has so lost touch with the founding principles of this country?
Well, it's because they are authoritarian followers. This is very typical, where they submit to the worldview of their people they're told are their leaders. They don't want to hear dissent. They are bullies. They are anti-democratic in their outlook. And they're the ones who are calling the show.
The essence of your second book.
Yeah, the reason I deconstructed many of Yu's arguments was to take a look at his intellectual honesty. There is none. And I'd literally just take several very telling examples just to show the kind, you just can't trust what this man says. It's really quite remarkable.
Yeah. We're talking with John Dean, his new book out, and you really need to get all three. I mean, it's a trilogy, and it's worth reading in order, frankly. Worse Than Watergate, Conservatives Without Conscience, and Broken Government. Brilliant, brilliant writing. Broken Government, the new one, How Republican Rule Destroyed the Legislative, Executive, and Judicial Branches. Mr. Dean, we have less than a minute left. The judicial branch, your thoughts?
That is actually, it's probably the most startling, and to me, it was the real eye-opener. It's an issue that I'm going to stay out between now and the 2008 election, because if one more seat goes to what I describe as a judicial fundamentalist, the law of the land will change, and it'll change slowly and incrementally, and it'll be forever different. And this is, to me, the greatest threat that is posed.
Is this the Federalist Society as well, or is it just a general philosophy?
Well, it is the Federalist Society. They're, of course, the training stable for a lot of the young conservative judges and what have you. But the fundamentalist approach is, if you take Scalia, Thomas, they're the prototypicals,
and dangerous.
And
at that, we'll have to leave it to people to buy the book, and hopefully that's a good enough tease that they will, because this is extraordinary. Broken Government: How Republican Rule Destroyed the Legislative, Executive, and Judicial Branches. John Dean, thanks so much for
keep
being
up
with
the good work, Tom.
You too, sir. Thank you. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
No surplus now, it's gone. Oh, the debt grows every day. Yes, the balance of our loans is bigger than Star Jones. Tell the kids they'll have to pay. I don't know what I'm gonna do. I wish this debt would go away. Could try to pay these bills, or sell Dick Cheney's pills, or put Congress on eBay.
Yes. George, you have all the best solutions. You always have all the best solutions. By the way, Air Americans, head over to airamerica.com/Tom Hartman page. Join the blog and start blogging and put you in the running for our daily giveaway at the end of the show. David, our producer, David Poole, is going to pick out his favorite comment on the blog over at airamerica.com. On the Tom Hartman page, and we'll send that person an autographed copy of my new book, or my most recent book, Screwed! The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. By the way, John Kerry has issued a statement following the arrest of a student at the University of Florida. The tasering of this kid all over the internet, probably it's going to be all over TV. I think I can safely predict Keith Olbermann at the very least will be showing it tonight. John Kerry says, and I quote, "In 37 years of public appearances, through wars, protests, and highly emotional events, I have never had a dialogue end this way. I believe I could have handled the situation without interruption, but I do not know what warnings or other exchanges transpired between the young man and the police prior to his barging to the front of the line and their intervention. I asked the police to allow me to answer the question, and I was in the process of responding when he was taken into custody. I was not aware that a taser was used until after I left the building. I hope that neither the student nor any of the police were injured. I regret enormously that a good, healthy discussion was interrupted. I'm guessing that those cops had previously been, you know, there for some Republican event, and they had been trained very well by the Bush-Cheney people, and I don't know. Actually, I don't know. That's speculation, but it's just, it's a tragedy. It's a tragedy, and it's going to reflect very poorly on the university. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. CJ in Colorado. Hey, CJ, what's up?
Oh, hello, Tom. I was astounded to hear that they're holding 84 pieces of legislation.
Yeah, it's and it's the Republicans who are doing it. And they're doing it so that they can claim that the Democrats are not capable of getting anything through through Congress. It's a disaster. Thanks for bringing that up, which leads us to Ellen Ratner. She's with the Talk Radio News Service. In fact, she's the big cheese there at the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, big cheese Ellen, how you doing?
Thank you. sometimes I feel like a bigger cheese than others. Welcome back.
thank you.
It's interesting. There has been some discussion as to whether Harry Reid is trying to water down some of the Iraq legislation in order to get Republican votes to agree with him and to get past those 60 votes. He's sort of getting criticism on both sides on that front.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he only needs 40 votes to say, sorry, we're not going to give you any more money. Bring them home.
Well, that's right, but, you know.
That ain't going to happen, right?
Right, and that is not going to happen. Also, a very interesting thing, I didn't see it a lot in the papers, maybe I missed it, but it was yesterday. House Homeland Security Chairman Thompson said that the Homeland Security demanded that the Homeland Security Department give him a list of all the programs that have been canceled, suspended, gotten rid of, whatever, because of privacy concerns. He said he wants to know which ones had been discontinued. He said that this was really a way of trying to find out essentially what Homeland Security is doing, because there's supposed to be a hearing in the beginning of October, I think October 1st, about exactly how they're going to use satellite technology to look at private citizens. And of course, you know, today is the day that the Director of National Intelligence is testifying before Congress on the entire issue of what is happening with the FISA court.
Yeah, this is from the, I believe it's the Washington Post, Pamela Hess. The top U.S. intelligence official asked Congress today for even more changes to a law that he says has limited the government's ability to eavesdrop, not just on terrorists, but also on more traditional potential adversaries. Mike McConnell, director of national
right.
intelligence in China and Russia, are aggressively spying
on
us.
Well, that's exactly
what they're going to. When are they going to start spying on you and me, Ellen?
What he said is that he said basically that we have returned to almost pre-Cold War levels on this today.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and during the Cold War, spying on average American citizens was common. I mean, look at J. Edgar Hoover going after Martin Luther King, for example. I mean, he couldn't sneeze without a memo going up to the director.
And, you know, it just came out that they went after Coretta King as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Everybody and anybody.
Staggering. Also, the president today had a rally on the White House lawn with various veterans. Meanwhile, the Democrats also had a rally with various veterans. Senator Patty Murray was involved. Several of the senators, House and Senate people, were involved. And one of the things they're going to try and do is to mandate a longer period between deployment of troops, which people are saying this would, of course, force a drawdown of the troops.
Or a draft.
Or a draft.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, the fact of the matter is there will be a drawdown of troops anyway in the spring, just in time to set up the election coming down the fall.
And you have to give some Republicans the Creativity Award. Tom Davis, he's the ranking member of the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform, said that he wants to have a hearing to see if the MoveOn.org ad was somehow a campaign violation because they got a reduced rate.
Oh, geez. Now, the ad that was run against the MoveOn.org ad that was funded by a Republican, I don't recall who it was. Was it the McCain campaign? It was Giuliani. It was the Giuliani campaign. They got the exact same price. That's the advocacy price. The New York Times says, you know, if you're a big corporation, you pay one price. If you're an advocacy group, you pay another price. That's been on their rate card forever. It's not like they got some kind of special deal. And Giuliani paid the exact same, I think it was $65,000. Giuliani paid the same price that MoveOn.org paid. Are they going to investigate Giuliani?
Well, I'm sure if the Democrats let the hearing take place, they will.
Okay, well, time will tell. And you can read all about it, learn all about it, and hear the audio clips on it all over at talkradionews.com. Thank you very much, Ellen Ratner with Talk Radio News. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman, 866-303-2270. Stick around.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. To the Tom Hartman Program, Viagra for your brain. This is Air America Radio.
There's an old saying. Welcome back, by the way, to the third hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you. There's an old saying that I have heard described as an old Middle Eastern or Arab saying. It probably is something you'd find in pretty much every culture, and that is, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. This is what we're doing in Iraq right now. You saw Bush, who has spent, by the way, a total of 15 hours in his entire presidency, 15 hours in Iraq. Three unannounced visits, super tight security. Oddly enough, Bush blogging. I kid you not. It was a military blog. Bush was saying, yeah, I'd like to be there. Sure would like to show up. He says, but one, I'm too old to be out there, and two, they'd notice me. Yeah. Like they're not noticing anybody else. But anyhow, there's this notion that the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and it's a matter of convenience over a short period of time. And this is the great danger that we are stepping into in Iraq with this policy that we're following in Anbar, and something that I think is really, really worth pointing out and really worth considering for a few minutes. If you go over to the blogs over at Wired, the Danger Room blog, What's Next in National Security, and Noah Sackman is blogging over there, and he's talking about how, in essence, this philosophy is being used by our military as a way of achieving a short-term victory in Iraq at the expense of the long-term. Now, keep in mind, Iraq itself, you know, most Iraqis today, you do the polls, most Iraqis today want there to be a united Iraq, but Iraq does not have a long history, contrary to an offhand comment I made last week. Iraq does not have a long history as Iraq. It was three provinces of the Ottoman Empire for a long, long time. So, you know, the idea that ultimately it will be balkanized, that it will be split up, there's something to that, although the parallels that people try to draw, including Joe Biden, frankly, and Louise and I are in Washington, heard him talking about this some time back, are somewhat flawed, because the Balkans were a border point. They were an end point. You know, they were the end. That was where the Ottoman Empire ended. Whereas Iraq was three states within the Ottoman Empire in the old, you know, for a long, long time, up until World War One. And so you have these Sunni leaders, these Sunni political and tribal leaders up in Anbar province in the northwest or in the west, over in the direction of Saudi Arabia and southeastern Syria. Two Sunni areas, you know, Saudi Arabia, Sunni nation, and those parts of Syria, very largely Sunni. And you have these Sunni chiefs, like, you know, the guy that did the photo op with Bush. And I remember looking at that, the look on this guy's face as he's shaking hands with George Bush. It was the look of somebody who's like, oh, man, what have I gotten myself into? And over the weekend, I believe it was. I saw it in the paper yesterday as I was on the train going across Germany. I don't remember the exact date. I wasn't, you know, here and paying attention to the news when it happened. But he was murdered. He was assassinated. But he was one of the Sunni tribals, you know, one of the Sunni sheikhs, one of the tribal chiefs. And basically what's happened, and this had absolutely nothing to do with the surge, this is something that these guys came to us. They came to our military back in 2003. Okay, just to keep in mind, in March of 2000, in May 1st of 2003, we had George Bush ending the war. Right? Bush goes in. And, I mean, we've got one hell of a military. We went in and we knocked down Iraq. We took down that country. We destroyed their infrastructure. We destroyed their political, you know, we took down the country.
My fellow Americans, major combat operations in Iraq have ended.
And so on. You know, you heard it a little earlier in the program. And so on May 1st in 2003, the war was over and the occupation began. And in that occupation, some of these tribal sheikhs in Anbar came to the U.S. government. They came to Bremer and company, and they said, we'll help you out. We already have a power system here. We have a tribal system, that goes back 1,000 years or more. A very local tribal system, and we will protect ourselves. We'll protect our own people. We'll make sure that you know, food and medicine is traveling around. We want to run our own show. And through Mr. Bremer, the Bush administration said, no, we are going to create a neoconservative paradise. We're going to do away with all this local kind of stuff. I mean, that's nonsense. We're going to throw open the entire country to transnational corporations, because after all, they're the salvation for everything. And any corporation can come into any part of Iraq and set up shop. They don't need any special permits like they used to have. They don't need to have an Iraqi partner like they used to have. They don't have to be owned 51% by Iraqis like used to be the law under Saddam. Still is in many countries. I mean, what I'm describing are in variations of how Japan and South Korea and you know, many countries are run today. And they said, no, we're just going to throw the doors open. Any company can come in, and they don't even have to hire Iraqis. They don't have to hire you guys. They can bring in people from Bangladesh who will work cheaper. They can bring in people from Sri Lanka. Turns out, when we look back, we see that they actually brought in people as slaves. They brought in people, they went into some of these third world countries, Bangladesh and Sri Lanka being the primary two, and said, hey, how'd you like a job at a fancy hotel in Jordan? You can make all kinds of money. And people said, oh, yeah, I'd love to be a waiter in Jordan. Yes. They get them on a plane, fly them over to Jordan, and then in the middle of the night, fly them into Iraq and say, ha-ha, guess what? You're in Iraq. By the way, we have your passport. You can't get it back until you finish the job. Our embassy was built with this kind of slave labor. So anyhow, we've made a deal with the devil, as it were, not wanting to characterize these folks as the devil, because they're just trying to get by as well. Hang on just a second. Excuse me. This is what happens when you spend 23 hours on airplanes and trains. Sometimes your throat doesn't just quite work the way you want it to. Anyway, so the Sunni leaders, finally we approached them 6, 8, 9 months ago and said, okay, we'll take your deal. We will help you out. We'll provide you with ammunition. We'll provide you with weapons. We'll provide you with autonomy. We'll stop fighting against you. We will not prosecute you for the hundreds, maybe thousands of Americans whom you have killed. And in exchange for that, will you please keep the peace? And they said, sure. It's a deal. Again, nothing to do with the surge. Now, here's where it starts getting weird. And this is where the Danger Room blog over at Wired is just so spot on. This comment by Noah Schachtman, who was in Iraq recently. He said that in order to consolidate the support of the Sunnis in that region, we are, if not countenancing, and these are not his words, they're mine, if not countenancing if not saying it's okay, if not paying for it, we're at least we're at least saying it's okay. Propaganda against the Shia. In other words, part of our support of the Sunnis is letting the Sunnis crank up hatred of the Shia in ways that are eerily reminiscent, frankly, of what was happening in the 1935 Germany, in 1936 Germany, 1937 Germany, with the propaganda against the Jews. Here's what Noah Sachtman writes. He says, I worry that'll be the case on the political scene as well. Sunni political and tribal leaders are increasingly throwing in their lot with U.S. forces here against al-Qaeda in Iraq and other insurgent forces. But to get them to come over to our side, the American military has fed them a steady diet of anti-Shiite propaganda. Arrests and killings of Shiite militants are announced from loudspeaker blasts. President Bush's bellicose rhetoric towards Shia Iran is reported on friendly radio programs. You know, this is crazy. I mean, we're trying to pull together a country that has a majority Shia in it by going into the Sunni areas and saying, the Shia are evil, they're terrible. They're aligned with Iran. It's the axis of evil. And when they're killed, isn't it a wonderful thing? We are setting up a civil war. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Blue in the chat room says, Keith Olbermann just had an emergency appendectomy. He's going to be gone for a couple of days. Keith, we wish you well. May you heal well and avoid those creepy infections that are floating around hospitals. One of the most important voices on television. And hope all is well with him. Strange things happening out there in the world. I mean, some very strange things. Santa Cleric and her husband, Adnan, going online into a chat room. She used the name Sweetie. He used the name Prince of Joy. They spent hours, they didn't realize they were talking to each other, spent hours telling each other about their troubled marriages. They decided, hey, we're perfectly compatible. This is great. Let's meet. Let's have a date. I was suddenly in love, says the wife, Sana. She says, it was amazing. We seem to be stuck in the same kind of miserable marriage. Yeah. So they show up for their date, and guess what? It's you. No, it's you. What are you doing here? Incredible. Oh, man. If only the rest of life was like, you know, if only those were our largest problems, right? If only that was the head of the news instead of the Bush administration's planning to attack Iran. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. TomHartman.com. AirAmerica.com for our blog. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room or if you wanted to participate in our message boards. Jeff in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Great show today.
Thank you.
Listen,
glad to be back.
In the local paper that the Iraqi government is considering kicking Blackwater USA out of their country, finally.
Well, the Iraqi government has already said that they want to do that. The question is, do they have the authority? Apparently they don't.
What about their national sovereignty, Tom?
Yeah, right.
Listen, this hit home for me because, you know, not only have I had a couple of customers, as you know, I'm a letter carrier, I've had a couple of customers who work for Blackwater. Mm-hmm. And who you know, are doing it for the money. And actually, a friend of a friend, the guy who worked with a coworker back in the Army, was actually one of the four guys who was, you know, massacred in Fallujah, which was the beginning of the end for the occupation.
Yeah.
So, you know, Blackwater is a screwed up company, and if we can help the Iraqis get rid of them, I say go for it.
Well, it's not going to be for you or me, Jeff, but I understand your sentiment. Jim in Orenco, Oregon. Hey, Jim.
Hello. Yes, I had a comment on each of your two topics this morning. Can
mm-hmm.
you hear me okay?
I can. You're just fine.
Okay. The first... with regards to John Dean, I really admire his courage when he told the truth, and he told it at a time when it really counted, and that's I really admire him for that. But also, I strongly disagree with his conclusion that impeachment at this time is not worthwhile, quite to the contrary.
No, he didn't say it wasn't worthwhile. He said that it's not going to happen.
Okay.
He said, and I think probably in a practical sense he's right, that pretty much from now until the election, anything that the Democrats do will be viewed as purely political by the vast majority of Americans. And therefore, it's politically impractical to impeach Bush. And you know, they should have done it 6 months ago, frankly.
Well, I think, maybe that's correct. But I think impeachment with a conviction would admit to the world that we as a country made a mistake, and that would go.
No, I agree. I agree. I am still in favor of there being impeachment proceedings. I believe that there is ample evidence right now, and John Dean laid it out in his book, and others have laid it out in their books. We've had several people on this program who have, you know, have written basically indictments of President Bush, including a number of Republicans. This is not a mystery. He has certainly committed impeachable offenses, as has Dick Cheney, and this is why Dennis Kucinich has introduced, 333, I think is his piece of legislation, calling for the impeachment of Cheney. It would be a fine thing. The reality is, frankly, I don't think it's going to happen, but it would be a fine thing. Dan in San Diego, listening on KLSD. Hey, Dan, got about a minute before we got to take a break at the bottom of the hour. What's up?
About John Dean saying the system is broken, and he's correct on that, and it's not just the three main branches, it's the press and the public as well. And I think that the mistake the Democrats are going to make is they're going to try to govern, and they should, you know, at least try to fix government first. You know, it's kind of hard to govern if government is broken, and, I mean, they need to get
rid of it. The problem is so many of the fixes either require legislation, and you've got all these senators who are blocking the legislation so that the Republicans can claim come election time that the Democrats didn't do anything, or it's going to require rolling back executive orders. I mean, there's this mind-boggling number of executive orders.
Yeah, they've got to do all that, plus probably divest the media as well.
Yeah, well, and that's a whole other thing. And the bottom line, frankly, I think, is that none of this is going to happen until there's a much larger Democratic majority in the House and the Senate and a Democratic president, which means that we've got to start getting active today. It's not going to be enough to vote. I'm telling you, these guys have got a whole bunch of tricks in their back pocket, from caging, which is still ongoing. I mean, Tim Griffith, nobody's even looked into him. Here is this guy working for Karl Rove, caging Sarah Taylor, admitting to it on television. It's a crime. Nobody's even looked into it.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
It's not the makeup or the way that you dress. It's not your appearance they all detest. It's not your manners, but that you got it in you. Ooh, it's your attitude.
Yet any time you and I question the schemes of the do-gooders, we're denounced as being against their humanitarian goal. They say we're always against things, we're never for anything. Well, the trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so. Now,
yeah. Wasn't he a funny grandfatherly figure, yeah? Who destroyed the American middle class? Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-303-2270. Christy Harvey's going to be with us in the next segment. Some breaking news coming out of the Justice Department. We'll share that with you in just a moment. First, your calls. Patrick in Monterey, California, listening on KRXA. Hey, Patrick, what's up?
Greetings from May Brussels, country, Tom.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure and a privilege to talk to you.
What's up?
And I wanted to say that I hold you in the highest regard and keep you in August company with Randy Rhodes, Amy Goodman, Bill Moyers, Ray Taliaferro and Bernie Ward from KGO out here on the left coast, and I think Lionel's fucking
enough. I got it. Thank you, Patrick. What's your question or your issue?
I had some quick comments, and I wanted to end with a question. But before I do, I was hoping sometime before you wind things up today, if you could play two clips. I think it's Richard Viguerie in Church saying how low voter turnout helps to Republicans. And the Limbaugh quote about Roosevelt is dead, because I was planning on sampling those for a musical project.
Okay, you got it. Here comes Paul Weyrich, actually, right now.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
That Paul Weyrich, one of the godfathers of the Republican movement, and, of course, Mr. Limbaugh.
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
So, there you go. Carl in Brownsville, Oregon. Hey, Carl, what's on your mind today?
Hey, I just wanted to tell you the secret for the Democrats to increase their holdings and keep them forever. I'm dead serious. You may not agree with me, but I want you to know that I really do respect you. Any candidate, Republican or Democrat, that says we're going to follow the Constitution and the Bill of Rights will win power and keep it. And that includes the Second Amendment. If the Democrats drop gun control as one of their babies, they will hold power forever.
I'm inclined to agree with you. Bernie Sanders has a 100% voting record with the NRA in Vermont. Vermont, in fact, is the only state where you can carry a concealed weapon without a license or a permit.
Alaska.
Alaska
as well.
Oh, Alaska, yeah, okay. I guess it's the only continental
right.
or whatever, you know.
Right.
And it also has one of the lowest murder rates in the country. Bernie's position has always been this is something that should be up to the states and the local governments, not to the federal government.
Right.
And I agree with him. I think that it's entirely appropriate that New York City have gun control laws, and I think it's entirely appropriate that in the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont people can drive around with a shotgun in the back of their pickup truck.
Right.
And I agree with you that I think that the Democrats have shot themselves in the foot, no pun intended, on this issue a number of times. David in Santa Rosa, California. Hey, on the other hand, let me just add, there is no reason why anybody should be able to own a 50 caliber machine gun that can, you know, take out a car from a half a mile away, or a weapon capable of a 50 burst automatic fire. David in Santa Rosa, California. Hey, David.
Yeah, Tom, but those weapons aren't for hunting. Those are weapons for defending your rights in case there's a coup or something.
That's my point. The founders didn't put the Second Amendment in because they were anticipating a coup against the federal government. Second Amendment in because they did not want there to be an army, a standing army during times of peace. They wanted to have a Swiss-style government or Swiss-style army where every man between the ages of 17 and 47 was a member of the military. And therefore had a gun in his home for that. That's why
right.
that's in there.
That's right. And they had a state-of-the-art weapon in that day and age, and they were under controlled militia formations. I don't have an issue with that.
Right. And they also did not allow people to have cannons. They didn't allow people to have battleships. I mean, if you want to extend that logic that the Second Amendment was to take down a government, it doesn't hold up. But it doesn't hold up in the historical record either.
Well,
anyhow, David...
But I had heard that they did have cannons back then, privately owned, but that's not the reason I called.
Okay. The reason you called?
The reason I called was The 9/11 folks have been, you know, saying we really need to have an investigation look into 9/11. It's not as the Bush administration has sold it. And it was controlled, the King-Hamilton Commission, right out of the White House by Zelikow. And the real issue that I wanted to mention was this B-52 and the nukes. Now, it's illegal. They were supposed to be transported on trains if they wanted to go somewhere. They were configured on pylon tripods, one on each side of the wing. There's six that go on those configurations. And the discrepancy is the flight path that B-52 took. It was westward over Nevada and Arizona and then eastward back to Barksdale. And apparently there's a discrepancy in the number of nukes that actually got to Louisiana. And you know these guys, they love pretext. If a nuke goes off or if a nuke is used to trigger an earthquake, if possible, the thing is that FEMA has been training for a terror attack on New York, a Class 5 hurricane in New Orleans, and an earthquake in California. The levees in California are substandard. They're made by the
so let me just pause you here, David. You're suggesting that one of these nukes is missing and might be used in a false flag operation here in the United States. Is that your point?
Well, they have these big... They have this big search going on for Steve Fawcett, coincidentally, celebrity, in the same area where this nuke may have been lost. They've got watercraft with sonar. U.S. Air Force generals on the ground looking at this, and there's a fifth mile.
David, I've seen. I'm going to stop it right here, but not because I'm disagreeing with you. I've seen so much stuff about this on the internet, including stories about how all six of the guys who were involved in loading the planes are now dead. I just don't know. It's one of those things that is taking on a life of its own. And, frankly, I think that it would be great if we still had investigative journalists in the United States and people doing some serious looking into this stuff. Joe in Portland, because I just don't know. Joe in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Joe.
Hi, Tom. I'm a longtime listener, and, I sure do appreciate your show.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you about this vortex I heard you talking to one of the gentlemen about.
Yeah.
Would the president have a veto for that?
Yeah. The president has the power to veto, you know, pretty much any legislation. All taxation has to originate in the House of Representatives. Then it would have to be ratified by the Senate and passed along to the president, and he could veto it. And probably would. In the past, every time we've had a war, we've paid for it with taxes, with the exception of the Vietnam War, and we paid for that with the recession that Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan inherited. Roger in San Diego, and we're still paying for it. Roger in San Diego, California, listening on KLSD. Hey, Roger.
Hi. If we're a society ruled by law and nobody's supposed to be above the law, well, if you or I were to commit a murder, the police would likely arrest us. Now, of course, in the case of Bush and Cheney, there is at least a reasonable suspicion of to commit conspiracy to commit mass murder. Why can't one of our police agencies arrest Cheney and Bush?
That's a good question. First of all, there may be some level of immunity there. I don't know. Some analog of diplomatic immunity. But the bottom line is that the remedy that the founders put into the and the Constitution also says members of Congress, and Cheney presumably is a member of Congress as president of the Senate, cannot be arrested except for high crimes and misdemeanors during their term when they're at Congress or on their way to or from Congress. But, the real remedy that the founders and framers put into the Constitution is impeachment. That's the real remedy. And that's what we need to be looking at, frankly. And I still don't think it's too late. I the practical part of me, the political observer part of me says, yeah, it's too late. It ain't going to happen. I still, however, absolutely think that at the very least, Dennis Kucinich's proposal to impeach Cheney is an important one. Laird in Eureka, California. Hey, Laird, welcome to the program.
Hi. Yeah, I'd like to answer your last caller real quick. It's because of the Cheney Act, which hasn't been announced yet because the Americans are all on need-to-know basis.
Okay.
Anyway.
Yeah, that's a good one. You're probably right. Giddy in Seattle. Hey, Giddy, what's up?
Hi. I was calling because you had mentioned with John Dean about the pieces of legislation, 86 or something like that.
Yeah, I believe it's 85. Yeah.
That have been that are being held up and by the Republicans. And I was my question is, How do they do that? I'm not really sure of
any senator can put a hold on a piece of legislation. They used to be, and I think it maybe still is, they can secretly put a hold on legislation. In some cases, Ron Wyden, for example, our senator from Oregon, has publicly put holds on a couple of things, including one was a nomination of the guy for head of OMB, as I recall, because he just felt it's the wrong guy. And senators have tremendous power to just basically block the political process and do that. The secret holds are the sneaky ones, and these are the ones that have been used by the Republicans in some really, really scary ways recently. Tim in Kirkland, Washington. Hey, Tim, just a couple of seconds here before we've got to take a break.
No problem. I just was following the Blackwater story, and hope they stay there. Want to make sure that Iraqis fight them in Iraq so we don't have to fight them here.
Yeah, well, you know, after seeing armed men, people walking around with military ordnance and military outfits in New Orleans after that debacle, and now with the end of Posse Comitatus, it's not quite a joke anymore. It's not quite a joke. Not specifically to speak of Blackwater, just in general, it's not quite a joke. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
When the paycheck just ain't stretching like it might have once before, 'cause the good jobs are all gone, left you in some big box store. Between food and rent and medicine, seems the suit's frayed a little bit more. When the boss cut that last corner, they walk out of those doors. When the truckers hauling sweatshop stuff won't stop there anymore. When the folks won't cross your pickets 'cause their folks the same as yours. That is one big union.
Yeah, let's just remember in the 6 years, going 7 years of the Bush administration, over 5 million people have slipped into poverty. Nearly 7 million Americans have lost their health insurance. Average median household income in the United States has gone down by nearly $1,300. 3 million manufacturing jobs are lost. 3 million American workers have lost their pensions. Home foreclosures are now at the highest on record. Personal savings rates below zero. Real earnings of college graduates have gone down 5% in the last 3 years. Entry-level wages for male and female high school graduates fallen by 3%. Wages and salaries are now the lowest share of gross domestic product since 1929. Ain't the Bush administration wonderful? By the way, we have a winner's not quite the right word because it's not a contest, but David has picked his favorite blog from today's blog over at airamerica.com/Tom Hartman page. It is by Terabytal, and the blog is Bill Belichick for Attorney General. Here's the reasons why. One, he's not a lawyer, but he has no personality, so he seems like one. Number two, he knows how to spy. Number three, he cooperates with investigations. And number four, nobody can say he's not a patriot. So congratulations to Terabytal. You'll be receiving an autographed copy of my new book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. Christy Harvey is with us with the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org. She's the Director of Strategic Communications at the Center and creates the daily news prep site, MikeCheckRadio.org. And Christy, you've got some breaking news.
I do. This is a hot story. It just broke online, and it's going to be all over the newspapers tomorrow. But it turns out that the Inspector General of the State Department is now under investigation for doing some very bad things. His name is Howard J. Krongard. And this afternoon, Henry Waxman, the mustache of justice, if you will, and his House Committee on Oversight sent him a 13-page letter saying that he's under investigation and charging him with interfering with ongoing investigations to try to protect the State Department and the White House from political embarrassment. And it's not one thing that he's done. It's not two things. There is a laundry list of all of the things that he has done to block investigations, twist investigations, and just some really nasty stuff in here.
Now, this is the exact opposite, is it not, of the job description of the Inspector General of the State Department. Isn't the job of the Inspector General of the State Department to be basically the cop who makes sure that the department is operating within the law and that people are operating ethically and appropriately and doing their jobs?
Absolutely. But in this case, he's a dirty cop and, really abused his power to try and protect his friends.
Should we put the word alleged before all this stuff?
Yes,
or is this
being charged with it? This is alleged. They're starting the investigation. So, yes, okay. Everything I'm about to say, throw an alleged in front of.
Yeah. All right.
But one of the things that he allegedly did was, you remember a few years ago, I guess it was last year, Karl Rove's best friend guy, Ken Tomlinson, who was the head of the Broadcasting Board of Governors, mm-hmm. had to resign because it turns out he was misusing State Department funds and he was running some horse racing or horse breeding farm out of his
Right, at the same time he was in charge of NPR, basically.
Exactly, that guy. Well, it turns out that while the State Department investigators were investigating him, this guy, Howard Krongard, who's now under investigation, was tipping him off. There are emails that show that he was tipping this guy off as to how the investigation was proceeding, what they were doing, and basically, getting him an inside scoop on how the investigation against him was going.
That's
very
incredible.
Bad stuff.
Yeah.
He also, we found out that when the State Department hired a company to build that U.S. embassy over in Iraq, the mm-hmm. group that they hired, First Kuwaiti, got in trouble because they basically brought in slave labor. And they lied to foreign employees about where they'd be working, shipped them to Iraq, and then confiscated their passports so they couldn't escape, and then they made them work on our embassy.
Right.
Labor laws be damned, I guess. And
yeah.
So it turns out that when he was alerted to this, in a very a highly irregular move, they're calling it, this guy, Howard Krongard, stepped in and absolved First Kuwaiti of the allegations, saying nothing to see here, you keep going, and he blocked anyone else from investigating these charges.
Nothing wrong with these droids, just keep moving along.
Right, yeah. Right. Avert your eyes, no slaves, don't look at the slaves. Really bad stuff. He also refused to let any of his investigators go to Iraq or Afghanistan to check out on any of the other questionable contracts, which is what the State Department IG is supposed to be doing in the first place. But he was so afraid, they think, that they would find bad things happening and fraud and waste and abuse that would be a black eye to this administration with all of their no-bid contracts, that he thought it was better to protect his friends higher up and block these investigations from going forward is what.
How'd this guy get the job in the first place? Is he a big Republican contributor or something?
I've got to look into what his background is, because I'm not quite sure. I know that he has a long history with Karl Rove, but he was not in the Foreign Service. He was just an outside lawyer with some group that I don't really know where he was first. But,
yeah,
he doesn't have a background in what they hired him to do. Usually this job is held by someone who's been a member of the Foreign Service, and he was not.
That's amazing. Well, you can read all about it over at AmericanProgress.org or ThinkProgress.org. Christy Harvey with the Center for American Progress. Thanks, Christy, for the breaking news.
Thank you very much.
Great talking with you. Coming up tomorrow on the program Wednesday, I'll be challenging conservative David Harsanyi on his book, Nanny State, How Food Fascists, Teetotaling Do-Gooders, Priggish Moralists, and Other Boneheaded Bureaucrats Are Turning America into a Nation of Children. Yeah, right. Corey Powell is here from Discover Magazine, The End of Science in America, plus the best of the rest of the news and your calls. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.